join us as they come.
Okay, all right. So, firstly, Erev Tov. Good evening, everybody.
Just mute yourself if you're not speaking. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. This is the second session of the series that we're doing, the Summer Learning Series, which has a kind of motif to it. It has an underlying agenda of dealing with disputes and dealing with famous arguments. And last time we saw how people argued in a respectful way, right? They definitely disagreed, the Soloveitchiks definitely disagreed, uncle and nephew, about the state of Israel, no question about that. But, you know, do it respectfully, do it in a way which is to do it in a way of pleasantness, you know, and respectfulness. And today I thought maybe if we're dealing with disputes, I wanted to bring into play two discussions, one from the, again, from the ancient world. I'm trying to sort of cover two bases at each session. And one from the more modern world. It's not quite the world we call modern 21st century, but it's from the 18th century. So, you know, it's pretty, we can sort of stretch it a little bit and call it modern. And we're going to meet two, I'm going to call them Rebbetzins. One is actually known as Rebbetzin, and the other one was a Rebbetzin, but she wasn't known as that. And they are both remarkable women. And the reason why I'm saying this, and not the number of things that inspire me. Number one is the fact that when we read about their disputes, in one case a dispute with a husband, another case a dispute with a very, very significant rabbi, the Rebbetzin A disputed with Rabbi B, which is pretty intense if you think about that, we'll find that these people were truly remarkable. Today, to have women who are knowledgeable and learned and able to defend themselves, to stand their ground in terms of Torah, is something which I think we're becoming more, certainly more aware of. We have fantastic places of study, both in this country, Yeshiva University, Stern College, various other colleges, Queen's College, Torah, where girls can go and study to a very high standard of Torah knowledge. We have fantastic colleges in Israel. We have seminaries and Michlala and all these wonderful, wonderful places. And there are wonderful young women who are now working in the context of Jewish law. Some are attorneys in Israel, what they call rabbinical attorneys, dealing with cases of in the Bet Din, etc. And again, remarkable, remarkable women are being produced today. The question is, what about 2,000 years ago? What was the situation? Were there any significant people around who one can look to as a kind of role model in this particular discussion? And I just want to extend it a little bit by saying why it's so important to talk about these women. If I had a picture, I'd show you, but there are no pictures. And that to me is a very sore point. I'll just tell you a little anecdote. The book about Rebbetzin Kanievsky, Zichron Livrocha, the wife of Reb Chaim, who is one of the great rabbis of this generation. She passed away a number of years ago. And two books came out more or less at the same time. I think Arscroll did a book and another publishing company. And I think the Arscroll book, they took it to Reb Chaim to show it to him. This is about the Rebbetzin, and you know, they thought it'd be a comfort for him. And he looked at the book. I don't think he reads English, so I'm not sure if he actually understood what the book was saying. But he asked one question, and it was such a basic question. He said, "This is a wonderful book, but where are the pictures of my Rebbetzin?" He said, "There's not one picture of the Rebbetzin in the whole book. There's no pictures of any women in this book." I mean, we're in that world today where this sort of thing is considered to be, you know, the way to conduct yourself. And his comment was very significant. He says, if you don't see a picture of a woman who conducted herself in the way that my Rebbetzin conducted herself, how is anyone really going to learn about what she was all about? You can read it. It's like being told the ingredients of wine, but until you taste the wine, until you drink it, you won't know really what it tastes like, what it's about. And he was, I don't say he was upset, but he was a little bit taken aback that there was no picture in the book of the Rebbetzin. And this is the world, unfortunately. I say unfortunately because I think it's really quite scandalous what's going on today in certain circles with this particular topic. Because again, it's an opportunity as an educationalist to see how women really do conduct themselves in their particular communities, and one can learn from that. It may not necessarily be the way that you would conduct yourself, but you know, there's a role model there which we can learn from. But without a picture, it's very, very difficult to know even what we're talking about. So what I'm doing this evening, very challenging as it is to try and give you a picture of two very different Rebbetzins. One, as I said, from the ancient world, and one from the more modern world. And the subject matter is fascinating. The first Rebbetzin, I think, more or less everybody has heard of, Rebbetzin by the name of Bruria. Very famous lady in the Talmud, Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir. And she was a phenomenal scholar. There's no question that the Talmud talks about it. In one place it says that every day she learned 300 halachot every day. 300 halachot is like, if you know the Mishnah Berurah, this famous book that everybody studies, it's probably like learning, you know, sort of, I don't know, 50 pages of Mishnah Berurah a day. I mean, it's like unbelievable. Okay, and this is what, I'm not going to call her Rebbetzin, she's just known as Bruria, right? This is her daily diet of Torah study. Incredible. Amazing, amazing woman. And we know there are various situations where she stood up and argued with rabbis, and she put forward her point of view, and her point of view was taken very seriously. The interesting discussion is with her husband. She disagreed with her husband in a matter of very significant, I would say, not necessarily halakha, but it was certainly what we would call today hashkafa. Hashkafa meaning outlook. And it's to do with the situation of, how should we put it in the 21st century? The word that we use today is rehabilitation. In the situation of someone who has, let's say, committed a crime, how do we rehabilitate that person? And if they're serious crimes, and of course this sort of moves itself into the whole discussion about capital punishment. Do we promote it or do we not? In America it still exists, in England it's gone out, it's been gone for the last 50, 60 years. Right? I remember talking once to one of the Dayanim of the London Bet Din, Dayan Morris Swift, whose brother was in Englewood here, Harris Swift was a rabbi here, and he was the witness of the last Jewish person to be hanged in London. It was quite, I don't think he ever got over it. It was, he had to be there, they had to have a rabbi there, and I don't know why, but they had to. And he was a witness at this particular horrible, really, really terrible event. And the reality is that, believe it or not, Bruria and Rabbi Meir disagreed about the way to deal with people who are, how should we say, in a position where they are causing societal problems, they are violent, they are definitely not people who one can integrate, at least according to Rabbi Meir. You'll see, according to Rabbi Meir, you can't bring them back in. What do you do about them? And this is, again, I think a bit of a well-known discussion, but it's so interesting. Let me just go onto the screen, and I'll just show it to you in the text. Have a look at this. This is taken from Talmud Brachot. It's page 10a. You want to look it up? Those of you who have Sefaria, I talk about this all the time to my students, sefaria.org. It's the most phenomenal thing. Get the app, and on your phone, you've literally got the whole of Torah on your phone, on your smartphone. It's quite extraordinary. And here they bring this discussion. Listen to this. Unbelievable story. Hanu bar yune, there were certain hooligans. Bar yune is a word that we actually find the description of the people who were fighting Jew against Jew. These are Jews. These are not non-Jews. These are Jews who are very, just out of control. There is an element like this, I think, in Israel today as well. Right? In the religious community. Hanu bar yune tahava b'shavavute de Rabbi Meir. There were certain hooligans in the neighborhood of Rabbi Meir, wherever he lived. And what did they do? They gave a lot of tzaras. They gave him troubles. Don't ask. We're not even told what they said. They may have, who knows, they may have thrown bricks at his windows. I mean, who knows? they were, obviously he had said stuff or whatever, and they were very upset with him, to put it mildly. So what happened? Rabbi Meir was somebody you don't mess with. Have koboy Rabbi Meir, rachme lavayu, ki hecha dele mutu. So Rabbi Meir davened that they should be dead. Wow. That's a very drastic solution, right? What's the solution with these hooligans? Pray that they shuffle off the mortal coil as quickly as possible. That's pretty intense. His wife heard about it, and she was not so happy with her husband's solution. Amra le Bruria, Davita, his wife Bruria, said to him, and this is the famous Bruria, right? This is the we named the colleges after this lady. She says, Ma da'ato, what is, Rabbi Meir, my husband, what's going through your mind? What do you think? Why did you say they should all die? And why are you praying for them to die? It's not just saying it, but you're praying that they should die. He says like this, Mishum, so she, I think, she tried to give the reason for this. Because it says, and this is the verse that we say every Rosh Chodesh, Psalm 104, Mishum Tichtib Yitamu Chataim, that the sins should be, and Yitamu Chataim in Haaretz Roshayim Odinam. Baruch Yinafshi Et Hashem, Alulukal, famous. There's even a wonderful tune to this particular verse. But it says Yitamu Chataim, the sins should be ended. There should be an end to sins. So says Bruria, Mi Ketiv Chotim, does it say that sinners should be ended, do away with sinners? No. Chataim. It says sins. Right? Love the sinner and reject the sin. Right? And this is a principle which becomes very significant today in many other spheres of modern life. And therefore, as far as Bruria was concerned, Rabbi Meir was wrong. He understood the pasuk as saying "Yitamu chataim," the sinner should be done away with, whereas Bruria said no, chat doesn't mean sinners, it means sins. Pray that the sin should go away. In other words, pray that they should return to the fold. They shouldn't stay, you know, the wild men of Borneo that they are. They should become good, God-fearing, observant Jews. And in fact, it says, I brought here the English translation, this is all from the web page, and she gave him another argument. He says, my husband, you're not reading the pasuk right, you've got to read the verse. It says, va'od, right, I hope you're with me, it's that second paragraph. Shafil l'sefer dikra, look at the end of the verse. What does the end of the verse say? Urashayim od einam, there'll be no more wicked people, right? Be no more wicked people. So she says, Bruria says the following, and this is why she was a Talmudist. She could argue Talmud with him. She says, Kivan diyutamu chataim urashayim od einam. In other words, if you are telling me yitamu chataim means that the sinner should be dead, why does it have to go and say there'll be no more wicked people? Because the reality is, if all the sinners are dead, of course there's going to be no more wicked people. They're all gone, right? It's a redundant at the end of the verse to tell us there's going to be no more wicked people. If you say like Bruria wants to say that it's not the sinners but the sins, that the sins will go away, then it's correct. The sins will go away and the wicked people won't be wicked anymore. That's what the verse is saying. But not as the way Rabbi Meir said, that you pray for the death of the sinner. So she was very upset with him. She says, Elaboy rachamei elavai. She tells him. She says, Rabbi Meir, you've got a daven for these people to pray to God. Delehadru b'tshuva. They'll come back and repent. Sort of, you know, this is, again, an interesting discussion. Urashayim odeinam, and then there won't be any more evildoers. What a phenomenal, phenomenal lady. That Rabbi Meir was, you know, you're standing up to the chief rabbi of the generation. I know she's his wife, And I get that. But imagine in the world that they're living in, that she had the what we call the omitz, the courage, to stand up. And what she said was that, Rabbi Meir, you're making a big mistake, that you're davening for the death of these people when you should be davening that they should return to God. And look at the end of the story, the last two lines. Boy, Rachmei Lava, he actually started davening for them. And Vahadru B'tshuva, they really repented. Right, that was a better solution. Rather than saying they should all go and die, he started davening for them, and one by one they came into the yeshiva and they sat down, you know, and they, you know, the whole sort of bal tshuva thing. And this is an unbelievable discussion. It turns out, according to this, that what are they really disagreeing about? How to rehabilitate. Do you rehabilitate at all? According to Rabbi Meir, he would just basically advocate what we would call nowadays we would call it capital punishment or the equivalent. This is heavily punishment, but they would all be gone. Or do we listen to Bruria, which we do listen to because we do believe in rehabilitation, and we just have to pray for people that they will come back, you know, they'll do tshuva. You know, tshuva is a process, it's not an easy process to do, but at least that is a much more, how should we say, a much more acceptable approach when dealing with people who have gone outside the boundary of the law. And this is a fascinating argument, it really is fascinating. And it's interesting, the sefer I'm using, which I mentioned last time, which is written by Rabbi Navon, he's a rabbi from Modi'in in Israel, he says that we've got a similar discussion, in a way, about another famous story. Eitan has raised a hand. Let me go to Eitan a second, and you can ask your question.
Didn't he read Eov and Ninveh?
Is that story of Eov? Perfect question. You know what? I think we're going to have to say that he was at wit's end. I think that there seems to be the suggestion in that Gemara that, you know, he just doesn't have any other way of dealing with these very, very difficult people. I think what we need to do, and I haven't had a chance, is to analyze the word Bar Yunai. Right, you're right. Of course, there's Ninveh, there's Yonah, there's stories of Tshuva all the way through the Bible. But with Rabbi Meir, he may have got to the point, in his estimation, that these people, you know, we have this concept like with Pharaoh, that God hardened his heart because that's it. There's no way back. You know, they are absolutely unable to be saved under any circumstance. But of course, that's certainly not the derech that we promote, certainly not today, and I imagine certainly not then. But Rabbi Meir, we just are not told the way that they grieved him. We're not told what they did to him. And it could very well be that, again, this is an extreme situation. Your question is 100% valid. And Bruria would certainly support you in what you've just said, right? She would say, you know, go for it because you're right. Whereas Rabbi Meir seems to have taken the pasuk, Yitamu Chataim, as Chotim, that's it, done. I'm now finished. I'll pray for their demise and they are gone. It's very shocking. And I think to fully understand it, which I don't have time to do, we may have to look a bit into the background of Rabbi Meir and his Hashkafat Chayim, his view on life. There's a lot to say about Rabbi Meir as well. But I'm bringing this because I want you to see that there are really such interesting debate that's going on between husband and wife. And what is so encouraging is that who wins it? Bruria wins, right? She says, go and pray for their repentance. Wow, she won the debate. And that means she stood her ground. I'm going to leave you to do the homework on Bruria as well, because there's a very sad ending to her life. She actually, in the end, she kills herself. And it's a pretty shocking ending. It's not brought in the Gemara per se, but it's brought in a Rashi. Rashi in Gemara Avodah Zorah, page 18. And I'm going to leave you to look it up there, because it's a very sad and very, I would say, almost disturbing story. But that's what happened to Bruria in the end, and it's a lot to do with attitudes of women studying Torah. It's a much bigger subject than I wanted to go into this evening. But Bruria, in this particular debate...
Can I ask you, would you find it?
Sorry, I'm hearing some voices. Bruria in this debate was certainly able to stand her own ground, and she won over against her husband. And I just want to add a little extra example from the life of King David. Right? We just mentioned Tehillim, and there's something very interesting here. When David himself had such terrible sorrows from his children, right? We talk about this wonderful phrase in Yiddish, nachas from the kinder. David had zero nachas from most of his kinder. There's no, except for Shlomo, he really did not have nachas from his children. On the contrary, they all wanted to kill him. There were so many examples, Avshalom, and now, and at the end, Adoniyah. These were all children that wanted to take over the kingship at the expense of the life of David. They wanted to murder their father. And everybody asked the question, in fact, in the Tanakh, they asked the question, what happened? David, what did you do? What did you do wrong that these children wanted to do away with you? I mean, it's unbelievable. And here's the answer to the question that the prophet Jeremiah, who wrote the book of Kings, he wrote Sefer Melachim, what does he say? He says, Adoniyah, I'm just showing you this example, Adoniyah ben Chagit mitnatzei leimo ani emlo, Adoniyah's made an announcement, I'm going to become the new king. David is still alive. His father is old, but he's still alive. So he made a whole entourage, 50 men running like today, limousines and police riders and all the rest of it. And here comes the clue. His father had never rebuked him. He was the bubala that got away with everything. And this is a comment which I would suggest is in parentheses, in brackets, but it's a clue to the whole story. And not only to this story, but to the story of Avshalom as well. What did David not do? He didn't cure the problem at the point when he should have done. Like Brewery would have said, pray for them to do teshuva. Be in a position where you can influence them and try and bring them back to the straight and narrow, as we say. And instead of allowing them to go on their own way, which eventually leads to rebellion and, unfortunately, in the real extreme situation, leads to death. Look what happened in the end. I'm not going to go through the whole story, but in the end...
Rabbi?
Yeah?
Didn't Ruria's two children...
they die.
Die,
yeah, yeah. She had a tragic... Tragic life. Her
sent her over the edge.
And there's a discussion about that. Her father was one of the martyrs that was killed by the Romans, Hananiah ben Trajan. Horrible family situation that she had. And as I said, there's probably more to be said one day about Brewery, you know, a sort of bigger picture of who she was. I brought her because I felt that this was such an amazing thing that not only did she disagree with her husband, but we see clearly she won the argument. And she won it in such a way, wow, you know, that there was no compromise, there was no backing off. And that, in the second century, whenever it was, of the Common Era, must have been, she was a phenomenon, there's no question about it. And the rabbis almost, in many cases, give you the impression they were not very comfortable with her. Because she, as they say, she knew too much. For their generation, it was the men who should know, and the women were, you know, kept to the side. But Brewery was not having any of that. She was a lady who really knew her stuff. And there have been women, there's Devorah, and there's Avigail, there's a lot of women in Tanakh who came through that particular test, and Brewery you can add to the list. But there's much, much more to say, but I brought it because it's an interesting discussion in terms of what they were actually debating, what they were actually disagreeing on, right? And in the end, I've just brought this thing with Adoniyah, the son of David, where it says also, if David would have done a little bit more, in terms of upbringing and guidance and when they were younger, then maybe all of this tragedy would never have happened to lose his children one after the other. Amnon was killed and Avshalom was killed. And now, at the end, Adoniyah was killed. And it says right at the end, Shlomo, it's just the last two verses there, Shlomo instructed Benayol, the son of Yoyada, he was the head of the army, who struck Adoniyah down, and so he died. What did Adoniyah do in the end? After David had died, he promised to have nothing to do with the kingship, and then he comes along and he says, can I marry Avishag? Remember the famous woman who was brought to the king at the end of his life to keep him warm. And She was the wife of essentially the king's property, if you want to call it that. And the reality was that Adoniel should not have had mixed in. What he did, he unfortunately for him, Shlomo was smart. He was young, but he was a very smart guy. And Shlomo understood that Adoniel, making such a request, it was illegitimate. And he, in fact, deserved the punishment for being a rebel against the king. And Shlomo was told by his father, if this is the situation, Adoniel does not behave himself, you have full permission to bring the weight of law against him. And Adoniel was actually put to death. Unbelievable. And this...
Question.
Yes, please.
I want to read more of this story. Where in Tanakh would you find it?
This, which story? The story of Adoniel?
Yeah,
beginning of Kings. It's Malachim Aleph, chapter 1. It's literally the first chapter.
Chapter 1 of Kings number 1 or 2?
Kings 1. Kings 1.
Okay, the very beginning.
It's just about from Pasuk 5 through to the end of the chapter. It's a lot more to say about it. But the point that I'm trying to make over here, which is so, I think, really significant, again, is the fact that the principle, what I'm calling the Brewer principle, right? When we can influence and we can have an effect, we should try our best to do so. You know, don't leave it up to chance. Obviously, there's more to say in terms of parenting. This is a much, much bigger topic than what we're talking about this evening. But I think the point is made here that do we allow people in, people that we can have some sort of shaykh and some sort of connection to, just to disappear, to go off the rails completely? Or do we try and hold on to them as much as we can? And Bruria's solution was daven. Daven and pray that there'll be teshuva and people will come back. And I think this is really important. Because, again, I know many cases, and we struggle with this, of children that don't necessarily follow the derech, don't follow the way of Torah observance. And how do we deal with it? How does a parent who is observant deal with a child who's not observant? And the answer is that you stay connected. You know, it's tefillah, but it's also connection. There's a lot of factors which I'm sure, sort of we can think about, but not at this particular juncture. That's a whole another discussion. But what do we see in argument number one, which I thought was so fascinating, is the fact that Rabbi Meir, really the great rabbi of that generation, stands up and says what he says, they should all die. And Bruria says, God forbid, chas v'shalom, you know, this is not the way to do it. And Bruria wins the day. Amazing, amazing. I want to go to argument number two, because our time is limited. And here comes a real bombshell, right? I think many of you have heard of Bruria, but I don't know how many of you have heard of someone called Rebbetzin Baylor. Great name for Rebbetzin, right? Rebbetzin Baylor. Who was Rebbetzin Baylor? This is a whole story from it's the 18th century, the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. Let me tell you a story. The story goes like this. There was a rabbi, it's always a rabbi. There was a rabbi called Rabbi Yoshua. He was known as a Yiddish name, Falk, F-A-L-K, right? I guess that was a Yiddish name. Yoshua Falk Katz. His name was Katz, a Cohen. And he was a very, very great scholar. And he wrote a number of books on commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. One of the commentaries he wrote is very famous, called the Sama, the Sefer Me'irat Einayim. You find it on a classic standard volume of Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law. And he wrote commentary on what is called the Torah Shulchan Aruch, also on Jewish law. One book is called the Parisha, and one is called the Drisha. Go figure. Very, you know, two books almost with the same sounding name. He was a big scholar. He was a very, very great scholar. Very interesting. In his introduction to the commentary, which he wrote on the section of Shulchan Aruch known as Evin Ha'ez, I think it's there, the commentary on the section dealing with laws of marriage, he brings a whole discussion about, again, his thought process and why he wrote this particular commentary. And at the end, he says, I want to dedicate these next few lines in honor of my mother, Rebbetzin Baylor. Rebbetzin Baylor. Now again, Rebbetzin Baylor was a woman who clearly was a very learned woman. She was a woman who expressed opinions not just about you know, sort of the regular things that you would expect women to be upset about in the 1700s, 1800s, but she also expressed very strong opinions in halacha, in Jewish law. Go figure. This is Rebbetzin Baylor, who is quoted by her son, and I think, in fact, let me just get the mishpachology right. She was married to this Falk Katz, Rabbi Falk Katz, and they had a son called Yosef Katz. I think this is, and the son, Yosef, is the one who writes about his mother, and he's the one, Yosef Katz, who wrote the commentary. I think that's the way it works. So in his introduction, Yosef Katz writes about his mum, Rebbetzin Baylor. Listen to this. And this is a wow. And again, it's something which I suspect the ladies will be aware of. Maybe the gentlemen may not be so aware of this. And it's to do with the laws of lighting candles on, not Friday night, which is the regular time, but before Yontov. We have the ceremony of candle lighting at Lakat Nerot. We do it Friday night. And also we do it before Chagim, before Yontov. And this is the problem. The problem is a very simple halachic problem. And again, I think many women understand this probably a lot better than the guys do. What happens is that the following happens on Friday night. Every week, when the ladies light the Shabbos candles, what happens is that they strike the match, you light the candle, you do the thing to bring in Shabbos, which is always so beautiful, and you cover your eyes, I guess, as a symbolic act of not looking at the lights until you've said the bracha. So you ask the question, why don't you do the bracha first? We normally, if I hold an apple in my hand and I want to eat it, I don't eat the apple and then think about the bracha afterwards. I make the bracha first. I say, Bray Priya ate, and then boom, I eat the apple. So why, in the case of lighting candles on Friday night, do you do the bracha after you have lit the candles? And the answer is, very simply, because if you said the bracha before lighting the candles, you bring in Shabbos. And once you brought in Shabbos, you can't light the candles anymore. You're stuck. So there you are, being super religious, bringing in Shabbos and saying, you know, the bracha with great kavanah, with great concentration, and then you're holding the match, and you got to put the match down because it's Shabbos. You know, you're done. So how are you ever going to light the candles like that? So the rabbi said, we reverse the order. You light the candles first. You then do the whole thing to bring in Shabbos, a nice ceremony, and then you say the bracha after you've lit the candles. It's an exception to the rule. The blessing is usually said before you do the mitzvah. Lighting the candles is on Friday night. The blessing is actually said after you do the mitzvah, which is to light the candles. So I hope so far so good. This is the way we do it. Here comes the question which Rebbetzin Baylor was very upset about. The question is, what about Yontov? What about lighting the candles on Yontov? What should we do when you light the candles before Yontov? Should you do the same thing as you do Friday night? I guess you could argue it makes sense. Keep it even, Stephen, all the way through the year. Or you can argue, wait a minute, there's a difference. Because I know that Shabbos I can't light from a candle because that's the law of Shabbat. But what about Yontov? Can I take a candle which is lit and light something else? The answer is, I can. So in Yontov, why don't I do it the other way around? The proper way, which is to hold the match, to say the bracha, Sheikh Nishan and Sova, Tzivonu, etc. And then I go and light the candle. Rebbetzin Baylor believed with her heart and soul that that was the way to do it on Yontov. Different to the way we do it Shabbos. I'll just say it again. Shabbos, you can't light the candle. And you can't say the bracha and then light the candle, because once you've said the bracha, it's for all intents and purposes, you've begun Shabbat. So how are you going to light the candle? It's too late. You've begun Shabbat. So you light the candle first, and then you do the bracha after doing the ritual, the ceremony. But with Yontov, it's not necessary. Because Yontov, you can take a candle and light the candle after you've said the blessing, because the blessing should be said before you do the mitzvah. Eitan, you look perplexed.
Well, I thought you're only allowed to transfer fire in regard to cooking.
not in regard to anything.
Yeah, no, in fact, it's interesting. In this case, it would be one of the allowances of transference of fire, right? You would be allowed... I tell you
But generally, it refers only to cooking.
It's usually to do with cooking, but it can be for other things. For instance, if you're in a situation where you need light in the room, right, that you've had, let's say, a power outage. We had one this morning here. You know, you want to go and get some lights and you take a candle, or rather, an unlit candle to your neighbor and then bring back a light. You can light candles for that purpose as well, right? It's not just for cooking purposes. That's a whole discussion about the use of electricity as well. On Yom Tov, the rabbis were very, again, going back 100 years when electricity started, some allowed you even to use electricity on Yom Tov, right, to switch on the lights. And it's a whole discussion by itself. We don't do that these days, but the reality of it is it's complicated. Everything's always complicated in Jewish life. But let's go back to Rebbetzin Baylor, because I tell you something, this is a wow. So let me read to you from this article that I found. And who is she having the argument with? It's Rebbetzin Baylor, right? So her name is Baylor Katz. Let's just get clear her name. And she's arguing with a rabbi called Avraham Gumbina. Now, Avraham Gumbina is not a name that we would know, but the book that he wrote is well known. It's called the Mogen Avraham, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, very famous commentary. So listen to this. I found an article, again, on a website, which sort of crystallizes this whole discussion. At the end, I'll tell you what happened to Rebbetzin Baylor, because the story is amazing. It says like this, Agon Reb Yosef, this is the son of the Rebbetzin, Beno shel Aprisha, that the son of the person who wrote this great commentary, Bahakdamato, the Sifro shel Aviv, he's writing an introduction to his father's book. In other words, the book was actually written by Rebbetzin Baylor's husband. But who writes the introduction? The son, Yosef. He writes about the book. He says, Mesaper, third line, Bishvach Imo. He talks about his mom, Yiddish mother, right? Jewish mother. He wants to give her a bit of cover. Who is his mother? Rabbanit, the Rabbanit. Doesn't say her name, but it says elsewhere her name was Baylor. The Rebbetzin, his mom, he wants to mention her. Umevi Bishma, and he brings in her name, Shnei Chidushei Halacha, two halachic novelized, new ideas. Or not so new, but something which was controversial. And we'll deal with one of them. We're going to deal with both of them. Listen to this. Shneihem neged haminag hamekubal etzel hanashim b'hadlakat neirot Yom Tov. Both of the things that she spoke about, she saw women doing this on Yom Tov, what she considered to be wrong, and she had to get it off her chest. She made a halachic pronouncement. I'm assuming that she even went, because it says, you know, it says about her that she used to open up the shul every day. This is a woman who was dedicated to Jewish life in a way that, you know, you write books about people like this. She used to go in the morning when it was very dark, open up the shul, and she would spend an hour, 2 hours before the men arrived, already davening and learning and whatever. And afterwards, they would have a little l'chaim at the end, a schnapps or whatever, which she would be in the Ezra's Noshin. She would come over at the end and engage some of the gentlemen in halachic discussion. A formidable lady. Unbelievable. All right? I don't know many women who are like this even in this generation. But listen to this. Just go to the next column. It says, her problem was the following. Aval, b'yontav, shemutel ahadlik neirot b'yontav asma. You can light the candles on yontav because you can take one flame and light another flame. Mutav, she argued, it's better, shenaseh berkata neirot ketikuna. We should do the blessing on the candles the way that we normally should do it. In other words, the blessing before you light the candles. Liyot ha-bracha over la-siyatan, to do the blessing first, which is what we should do, as we do with every other mitzvah, except Friday night. Uladlik neirot shiyanta kamo neirot shachanukah. It's the way we light Hanukkah lights. We don't light the candles and then say the bracha. We do the blessing, make a nice song, and then we light the candles, and then, you know, we sing Mos too, but the whole thing is to do the blessing first. Then we light the candles. So that's Rebbetzin Baylor. Now here comes, I make no excuses for this rabbinic gentleman. I'm not descended from him, so I have nothing, no axe to grind over here, one way or the other. Listen to what he said. This is wild. He says, he's not happy about what Rebbetzin Baylor said. He writes like this. He says, following, De'im tevarech, we know Friday night, that if she makes the bracha first, kibla l'shabbat, she's accepted Shabbos, v'asola hadlik, she can't light the candle. That's the normal Friday night situation. So what you do is you light the candles first, and then you say the blessing after the whole thing with the hands. But for imkein, Beyontov Tavarech, normally you would argue maybe Yontov is different. You should make the blessing first. V'achakach tadlik, then light the candles, the way Rebbetzin Baylor said. Kain kata besov sefer derisha, be'evin ha'ezer, he says Evin ha'ezer, it's another section of Shulchan Aruch. B'shem imo, he says that the name of his mum. This is the Rabbi Katz that we just quoted, and the Rebbetzin Baylor Katz, and she's quoted by the Mogen Avraham. Is he going to accept her opinion? I can tell you now, if you're betting people, you're probably able to get the bet absolutely correct. He's not having any of this. He says, Aval, and he dismisses her. It's unreal. He says, Ein chachma li'isha. There's no wisdom to the woman. Oh! I'm glad he's not sitting in the room, because I think Yaffa would have probably had words to say to him. He says, and his argument, all right, he's got a valid argument, and his argument is people will get confused. If you do it Shabbos one way, you do it Yontov another way, you know, we're human beings, we'll end up confusing, and then we may do it wrong on Shabbos. Better to keep it uniform the whole year round. He says, "Delo cholku chachamim," the rabbis did not make any difference between one way or another. Better to keep it the way we always do, the same on Shabbos and the same on Yontov. And he brings a whole discussion over here. Listen to this. That's Rabbi Gumbina, 17th century, Poland. All right? Along comes Rabbi Landau, 18th century, Prague. And he is the great rabbi of his generation. About 50 years after Rebbetzin Baylor probably died. And he says the following. Unbelievable. He says, you know what? He says that if what the Mogen Avraham says, that we should always do it the same way for Yontov and for Shabbos, he says the same will apply to Hanukkah. He says if you're going to make a golden rule that you always light the candle out and then say the bracha, we should do the same thing for Hanukkah. Light the candles and then Baruch Adah Hashem, after you've lit the candles. Because why make a distinction, says Rabbi Landau. It must be from the lesson of Hanukkah is that there is a difference. Hanukkah we do it one way, and we all understand. And Shabbos we do it another way. So you know what? Yontov will also do it another way. You know, why do we attribute this lack of intelligence to the female population when we understand women are very intelligent and they'll know what to do, right? They'll get it right. And this is Rabbi Landau, who was the great rabbi. He's the Sefer known, his famous Sefer is called Noda B'Yehuda. Very, very famous, really. A lot of Landaus in the world today, all descended from Rabbi Landau. Very, very amazing rabbi. So let me say what he says at the end. V'siyem b'zeh lashon. This is Rabbi Landau's comment. V'chein nireh li, I would suggest, lahorot, that I will decide the issue, Ke'eshet ha-ga'on derisha, like Rebbetzin Baylor. I'm going to paskin like the Rebbetzin. Ve'hi isha, and look at how he plays with what the other rabbi said. It's a woman, nasa'a liba b'chokhma. Her heart was raised in wisdom. It's not that she wasn't smart, she was very smart, says Rabbi Landau. And he understood that she made an excellent point. I'll show you what I wrote here. This is the whole discussion about lighting the candles, etc., etc. I'll show you the conclusion here from Rabbi. This is an article by somebody called Rabbi Gross, lives in Brooklyn. And again, he brings also other rabbis who agree with the Rebbetzin. And he says, basically, Lefizeh, he says, according to this, Yesh lomar, demishum ze nishtaresha minhag ladlik balayla. It's a whole discussion which I don't want to go into about the other thing about waiting till it's night before you light the Yontov candles, or should you light the Yontov candles like we do Shabbos before Yontov begins. right? Second night Yom Tov, we've got no choice. We all have to light after the second night begins. But of course, in Israel, you don't have a second night. So he goes into a whole discussion. I don't want to go into that now. Listen to this. I want to read you something from this son. I tried to get this put onto the screen, but I couldn't do it. So I'm going to go back, stop sharing screen, and I'm going to read to you what happened to Rebbetzin Bela after her husband died. So the great Rabbi Yehoshua Falk Katz passed away. I don't know what year it was, but the son, Yosef, writes about his mother. He says, I'm going to read it to you. I'm sorry I haven't got it on the screen, but bear with me because it's unbelievable. Imagine what this woman was like. He says, and this is a woman who lived in Poland. Acha petirat avi mori v'rebi. Once my father died, chibaba ha'aretz la'alot le'eretz Yisrael Yerushalayim. The mother, on her own, decided to go and make aliyah and live in Eretz Yisrael. That today would be considered really brave. In the 1700s, it was probably unheard of. A woman on her own. Imagine the dangers that she must have, potential danger that she must have experienced. And it says, "V'kasher zachta ledavar zeh," she merited to go. "V'olechet v'sovevet al kol kivrei tzaddikim." She used to visit all the graves of the holy rabbi. Imagine what a rebbetzin this woman was. Wow. "Shebechol ir ve'ir," he says, she went to every city. "Hamonochim be'eretz Yisrael," in Israel. And we know how many graves of rabbis there are in Israel. "Lebesov yoshevet b'Yerushalayim," and then she settled in Jerusalem. Wow. "Kamo shmona shanim," for 8 years she lived in Yerushalayim. "V'shama'a hatov nitraba v'nitgadel sham," her name became so well known and so increased. "Ad lamala," everybody knew who Rebbetzin Bela was. She was one of the outstanding religious personalities in Jerusalem at the end of the 1700s. Go figure. "Uladati," and he says, Rabbi Yosef wants to, how did she survive? It was very frugal, it was very difficult. He says, "Meirov godel siguf nafsha." She didn't live on very much. She didn't have, she didn't eat well and all these sort of things. He says, eventually what happened, she did a lot of fasts. I mean, she was a tzaddikus. And she mo'asah b'olam hazeh, she rejected worldly things. She only wanted liknot nafsha olam haba. She only wanted to get, brownie points for the world to come. In which case, lo malush notel rak bat nun cheshanim. She lived to the age of 58. The whole story. And after shenoch nafsha, Chokol Hashem Kavod, after she died, they gave her a name of honor. V'chashu ligvor ota ben chashuvei aretz. She was buried in the most important part of the cemetery on, I presume, Har HaZeitim, or Mount Olives. And it says, where was she buried? B'toch arba amot, within 6 feet, shel keva Zechariah Hanavi. If you know where the grave of the great prophet Zechariah, one of the great prophets of the Bible, is buried, Rebbetzin Bela is buried right next to him. Unbelievable. And he says, Zechuta yamod la velanu, her merit should be for her and for us, ulezarenu, and for our children, ulechol beit Yisrael, amen, ken yehi ratzon. Wow. I mean, I'm out of breath just talking about this woman. Rebbetzin Bela, that's where you need an art score book. I've never heard of her till I found out this whole machloket and this whole discussion. And she stood her ground and she said, this is the way you should do it. And if you're telling me that Jewish women can't work out the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov, you don't know what you're talking about. Because, by the same definition, everybody can work out that Yom Tov is that Shabbos is different to Hanukkah. So why, if they can work out the difference between lighting on Hanukkah and lighting on Shabbos, why can't they work out the difference for lighting on Yom Tov as well? And Rebbetzin Bela was a phenomenon. Unbelievable. It gives me the shivers to think about this lady. And she's buried in Eretz Yisrael. I wish, after we've studied this, that when we all get an opportunity, please God, very soon, to go to visit Israel, that put it on your list to go and say a Tehillim, if we can, ask the guide, This will really floor the guide. The guide will have to, you'll say to him, hopefully he's a frum guy, and you'll say to him, do you know where this Rebbetzin, where is the grave of Zechariah? Hopefully he'll know where that is. And if he can tell you that, then you go and daven there. Next to the grave of Zechariah is the grave of Rebbetzin Bela. She deserves a tehillim from all of us. Because she was someone 58 years old. She wasn't old when she passed away. But what an amazing woman. Two incredible Rebbetzins. Rebbetzin Bruria, beginning with a bet, Rebbetzin Bruria and Rebbetzin Bela. Both of them inspirational women. Really inspirational women in their own way. And I had to share this with you because, you know, where in our tradition, as I said today, where things are just, I don't know, topsy-turvy in so many ways, if we know these women and we are aware of what they did and the example that they set, they can become the real inspirations for a whole generation. As so many other people are in their different fields and in their different achievements, let's think about Bruria, what she did, and let's think about Rebbetzin Bela. And, wow, both of them, truly, truly remarkable women. I leave it at that. As you can see, I'm a little bit taken with the second story particularly, which I knew nothing about. I never heard of this woman until I came across this whole article. And I wanted to share it with you because, you know, we need to know this. We need to know about the people that maybe we haven't heard of but are such special, unique individuals who inspire us. And there are so many inspirational women today, thank God. There are so many young women who are inspired to study Torah. And I have a little hand in helping them along the way, which I've always been very, very happy and feel very privileged to be part of that. But it's happening today that women are becoming more educated in Torah law and in Torah subjects. And thank God a million times because it's so important. Am I happy that there's a Rabbah? I'm not going to comment on that. I think the envelope has sort of got to a certain point. I'm not personally happy to push it past a certain point. But that we have Yoatzot and we have women who can advise in Jewish law and we have these rabbinical attorneys and all the whole development is just breathtaking. And long may it continue and long may it grow, along with knowledge of Torah, which we can all share together. I leave it at that. Are there any questions? Are there any comments? Nobody's walked out. Chemi, you're still here. You haven't walked out. I'm very glad about that. Yes, Yaffa, please.
So, yeah, you know, I'm thinking of Nechama Leibowitz.
That was
another amazing person.
Correct.
And I would be honored to call her Rabbah. Of course, she wouldn't take that title.
Nechama? Nechama would have actually been very upset if you said anything like that. She would really have. She didn't want to have anything to do with that side of things.
I understand that, but you know, if more women, Jack, stop. If more women would have had the opportunity, and I'm talking about through the ages,
yes,
if women had the opportunity to learn as the men did.
Yeah.
Instead of being relegated to you know, to things that are domestic.
Yeah.
You know, women would have excelled just as well as men, as is evident today.
As is evident today.
From lots of people.
Totally agree, 100%. Totally agree.
And you know, a woman that becomes a rabbah or yoetzet halakha, I mean, studies a lot of Talmud and a lot of everything.
Correct.
To a lot of halakha to get to that. So I don't begrudge anyone that title.
Correct.
I think that it's going to take maybe another century for Orthodoxy to get there.
Yeah.
Maybe never, but maybe, you know, maybe it'll take a little longer. But eventually, you know, I think it's going to happen.
I think so. I mean, it's happening now with the Yoetzet and with, you know, the women who are working in Orthodox communities. There's one in Philadelphia that's working over there. You know, you could contact her with questions in terms of particularly in family purity and stuff like that. So it is happening, and it's a wonderful development. And as I said, you know, when you look at the precedents, you look at someone like Burio, I teach Devara, and you see what, you know, the rabbis are very conflicted about Devara. They turn her into a law lecturer because they don't believe she actually gave decisions. She just had seminars about law. I mean, come on, you know.
She was a leader. She was the judge.
I mean, you know, that she used to convene seminars to discuss Jewish law. I mean, if you really believe that, I, with all due respect, you know, there are many rabbis who say it, but I've never been convinced, because these women are very special, and we need to know about them. We need to know, you know, what they did, what they said. I really am inspired. I'm inspired. Any other comments before I send you off? Wow. All right. Thank everybody. 2 weeks' time, Mirtz Hashem will be reconvening. I want to do some philosophy. Let's get philosophical next time. It'll either put you to sleep or keep you very wide awake, if you like that sort of thing. And in the meantime, I wish everybody Erev Tov. I hope this was inspirational, because they really are unique, amazing women. Really amazing women. I wish everybody Laila Tov. Erev Tov. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Laila Tov. Laila Tov.